So the theme of the exhortation is sight. And it's something, of course, that we take for granted, isn't it? Until we lose it. And then, of course, we realise just how precious it is. And the same goes not just naturally, but spiritually, isn't it? From a spiritual point of view, our spiritual sight is as important, or we would say it is more important, isn't it? As we live our lives in the truth, day by day, week by week. How grateful we should be that the light of the Word of God has shined into each of our hearts, that we've been called out of darkness and into the light of the glorious gospel. That's unlike the majority of this world that today are blind. They're spiritually blind, those all around us in today's world, full of no hope. They are no hopers. And yet, we've been given spiritual sight in this spiritually blind world. Now, as conditions in the world day by day get gloomier and gloomier, we reflect that although we're small in number today, what a privilege it is to be related to life and to light and to joy and to glory. Far greater glory than the glory of Solomon, for instance. Related to that same glory that will fill the house of the Lord in the kingdom, which we'll shortly be reading about in our readings from the prophet Ezekiel. But of course, it's easy for us to take for granted our situation, almost like Solomon did in his life. And we can continue to, although we are in light, walk in darkness, do worldly things, forgetting the one that has given to us the light and the life. And it was the New Testament reading from John's record that we'll be reading in a few days' time from John chapter 9, which made me think about our position. And that records in John 9 the healing by Jesus of the blind man. It's something we know, the episode we know very well. The giving of sight to one that was born blind, one born in darkness. And here we have a parallel, don't we, between this man that was born blind and ourselves, who were born blind from a spiritual point of view. Like us, spiritually, when we were born, this man was born in total darkness. He had never seen, he had never known what it was like, what he looked like, what anything looked like. And yet his life was transformed by Jesus, who gave him sight and who gave him a new life, just like we were given a new life. We had no spiritual sight at birth like this man, but in God's mercy and through Christ, we who have been born blind have been given sight. Now, as we read the record from John 9, the giving of sight to this blind man, we're apt to skip quickly over the incident in our readings, and perhaps we lose some of the drama, some of the lessons, because these miracles in John, of course, are part of the eight signs, aren't they, that were to teach spiritual lessons as well as being miracles. And indeed, the record does contain a spiritual lesson when we read of the dramatic account of this man that was given sight. If we use our eyes and our minds to dwell on the pictures that are presented to us in the scripture, and I'm always talking about pictures that come from the scriptures because that's what they are. We can let them form pictures in our minds, and that's what they're designed to do. They're presented to us in this way if we just think about them. And so our own lives have been transformed dramatically by the giving to us of this spiritual sight. What a hopeless position we would be without it, as hopeless as that man that was born blind. Now, John's record that we've started reading these last few days mainly deals with the incidents in the last week of Jesus. And therefore, it's very instructive concerning the main principles of enacted parables and events which Jesus crammed into these last few days of his mortal life. He knew that he'd only got days to live, and therefore all the things that happened in this last week were extremely important in the teaching of the disciples and in the teaching of ourselves. To prepare them and us for our own ministry, which we have day by day to carry on the work of Christ, and to convince us that Jesus, who was to be crucified within days and hours of these incidents, was truly the Son of God. So let's just have a look then. Let's use our eyes and our minds, our imagination, to look at this incident of the healing of the blind man, a dramatic incident showing us that when John's record shows these signs and miracles of Christ, it does so that there is no misunderstanding of the message. Let's try together to capture some of the drama, some of the flavour of this incident this morning. And those who among us are partially sighted or nearly blind will appreciate this word picture more than the rest of us. Now, the scene is set at the end of chapter 8 of John. Jesus was here in Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, and he'd been in the temple. And perhaps in our mind's eye, we can picture that, can't we? We've seen pictures of depictions of what the temple would have been like in Jesus' day. And we can perhaps picture him there in the temple. And he was particularly at this time engaged in a confrontation with the religious leaders in their own patch, as it were. He was taking them to pieces in their own territory. He was teaching the people that the truth would give them freedom. Sometimes we think the truth is restricting to us, but the truth gives freedom. And that's what Jesus was telling them, and the teachers were disputing the fact that they didn't need freedom because they were free anyway. They were in bondage to no man. They didn't realize their bondage to sin. They were in bondage to no man. And Jesus had a debate with them. And the end product was that they called him a Samaritan. And of course, we've read about the Samaritans this morning, who have no dealings with the Jews, social outcasts, really. And this is what the religious leaders called Jesus. They accused him of having a devil. And he disputed with them, telling them that their father Abraham rejoiced to see his day, but they twisted his words. And the end product of the discourse with them, let's just look at chapter 8, verse 59. Then took they up stones to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Yeah, in the end, even with all the crowds there, they wanted to get rid of Jesus, and they took up stones. Let's picture that. And they were going to throw those stones at him. But he managed to slip away from the temple grounds. That's what it says in a modern version. He slipped away from them. Can we picture the drama of the scene as his life was in jeopardy? And they wanted to end it there and then. But look what happened next. Chapter 9, verse 1. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. As Jesus passed by, or as modern versions say, as Jesus went along, escaping for his life, he saw this blind man. Now think of Jesus then, fleeing for his life, perhaps initially being sought by an angry lynch mob ready to stone him. And then right in the path of Jesus stood this blind man. Can we picture him? Here was a man in darkness and in need of his help. Those others in darkness who he'd been speaking to had said plainly that they didn't need his help. They refused his help and they tried to stone him because of his help. And yet this man, in Jesus' way, blind from his birth, Jesus saw as he was fleeing for his life. And this man truly needed sight, and Jesus knew it. Let's think about this man for a minute. Let's just build up the picture. Here was a man that was totally dependent upon begging on charity. There was no social security to bail him out. There was no Institute of the Blind. There were no guide dogs in his day. No NHS, no special allowances for her, no Beth Ezra to do anything for him. He would have spent his life begging and would have been known as the blind beggar. And he was a social outcast of the world. At that time, let's not forget that Jewish superstition taught them that bodily affliction equated with sin. He was a sinful man because he was blind. Either this man or his parents would have been a sinner indeed to merit one of the worst afflictions of blindness. And so we can picture Jesus as he's fleeing, passing by this blind man, and the disciples open up the dialogue, don't they, in verses 2 and 3. The disciples ask Jesus, saying, "Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him." And so then Jesus is diverted from his fleeing, from his life, and now concentrates directly on the needs of this poor blind beggar. This man was probably sitting, as he was known for doing, or leaning against the walls of the temple near the treasury, hoping to beg a crust, as it were. Put ourselves in the shoes of this blind man. He could hear footsteps approaching, and he could hear acutely people approaching him. And he no doubt cries for alms to ease his hunger. And his disciples are made aware of this picture, a picture that they've seen countless times before, and no doubt their hearts in those days had become hardened to such scenes, a bit like when I go to India and there are beggars by the thousand. What can you really do for them? But not Jesus. As he stops and he looks upon the affliction of this poor man, blind, helpless, hopeless. That was his state. But the blind man had heard at this point in time nothing apart from their approach. But then he hears the disciples remarking about his probable sinfulness, or the sinfulness of his parents. And he would think, well, there's not much hope of a handout from this lot. But now he perceives in the acuteness of his hearing one of the number doing something, spitting on the ground. Let's just think of his thoughts. So much for that. He'd heard plenty of people spitting on the ground before as they passed by him, probably spitting at him quite a lot of the time. And he might have thought, well, at least it's not spitting in my face. He would have been used to much abuse. Abuse of a well-known sinful man who merited blindness. But he heard something that would make him think. He heard one of their number justify him, saying that neither he nor his parents had sinned, and talking of the works of God being made manifest. Perhaps he had perceived even now that at least one person had some sort of compassion upon him. But all he heard was someone spit on the ground, and then a noise which sounded like the mixing up of something. And then he would have heard the approach of someone, and immediately he would have recoiled and tried to move his head away from what was beginning to happen to him. No doubt he thought he was going to be physically abused. And then he felt something wet and sticky being smeared on his eyes. Again, his first reaction may well have been one of self-defense. What was happening? And then he heard the voice, not of someone from Judah, but of a Galilean, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam." What would he do? Well, truly, he didn't particularly want to remain there with that sticky clay smeared all over his face. What did it mean? Perhaps he'd already heard of this Galilean miracle worker. Could it be him? Whatever he thought, he obeyed, like Naaman some hundreds of years before. Go, wash. And so this poor blind man begins quite a lengthy journey in his darkness from outside the temple, down through the narrow, twisting passageways of the lower city at a time of the feasting when Jerusalem would be full of people, amidst the thronging crowd which no doubt jostled him and taunted him and remarked about this sinner, this blind man, this idiot with clay running down his face. Perhaps some people helped him. But whatever happened, then down the winding, tricky steps in his blindness to the water, to the living water. We've read of that in John 4 today. This time to the well of Siloam, meaning sent, that water that was sent. On his way, as he left the temple area, he may have been in unfamiliar territory for a blind man. He may have actually asked for help to get to his destination. He would have stumbled along in his darkness. Can we picture him stumbling along in darkness, eager to get to that destination, to that well, and to wash? And the crowds in Jerusalem at that time perhaps jeering him, pushing him, taunting him. A sinner. Maybe a kind offer of assistance. Can we picture him now as he reaches that well, and as he bends down, and as he washes his eyes with a cool, fresh spring water, cleansing those eyes, and with it dispelling not only the clay, but the darkness which had been his life from birth. Let there be light. And there was light. Can we imagine him as he looked up, or perhaps as he looked down and saw a reflection of himself for the first time in the water? He knew what he looked like. And then he would look up and see the beautiful sky and the birds and the people and the buildings and the water. He would see beautiful, marvelous light that filled his eyes and his brain, for truly he had never had a recognition of it, like us who were spiritually born blind. His brain was overloaded with this beautiful sight. Imagine his joy as he returned to the place where he'd met Jesus. And yet Jesus was not there. He had disappeared. Imagine his joy as he returned to his parents and his friends, and imagine their joy and their unbelief at what had happened to him, at what miracle had brought about his sight. These things are all glossed over in the record, and yet they're there for us to contemplate. The bringing of sight to the blind, the bringing of light out of darkness. And so that light of Christ shined into the eyes and the heart of this poor man. But he was perplexed. He was puzzled. And all those that saw him were also, recognizing him as the blind beggar. Is not this he that sat and begged? "It is me," he says, "it is me, I can see, I can see." And that surely would have convinced them. But how could he see? That man could only answer that it was a man called Jesus who had done this to him. And a confession of this fact brought the Pharisees onto the scene with vengeance as they heard the news. Here was a man changed from darkness to light, from a living death to life and health, walking, running, working, doing a new life. Christ had given him a new life, just as he gave a new life to us as we had washed in baptism and been raised to a new life. But the Pharisees, hearts hardened as usual, could not perceive and did not want to perceive this miracle that Jesus had done to lighten the man's darkness. So what did they do? They set up a kangaroo court, as it were, to hear the matter, especially as this healing was done on the Sabbath day. Against the law of Moses was their were their thoughts, although Jesus said that he worked every day of the week, and particularly on the Sabbath day when it was God's purpose that should prevail. "How did you receive your sight?" they asked him. His answer, that a man called Jesus had made clay, anointed his eyes and told him to wash, "and I receive sight," he marveled in front of them. But the religious leaders made rubbish of his confession. "Jesus could not be of God. He doesn't even keep the Sabbath." Others recognized the folly of this line of attack by the Pharisees and defended Jesus because of the miracle that couldn't be explained away, apart from the fact that Jesus couldn't possibly be the sinner that the Pharisees claimed that he was. The crowd was divided, and argument ensued, and yet this man stood there. He was a living witness of the work of Jesus, and yet he was dumbfounded. And so the religious rulers say, "Call his parents." And so his embarrassed parents were brought into the picture, fearing greatly the Pharisees, frightened of being excommunicated from the synagogue and losing their position within the community. "Is this your son? You say he was born blind. How does he see?" His parents, fearing of being ostracized, answered, "Yes, he is our son. Yes, he was born blind. But how he sees, you ask him. He's a grown man. You ask him. We don't know." We can see their position, can't you? As they stood against the fierce Pharisees of the day. And so again, they called the man that was born blind and they ordered him to change his story and to give God the praise. It was not Jesus. Jesus is a sinner. And the answer, "I don't know whether he's a sinner or not, but one thing I know. I was blind and now I see. How did he open your eyes? I've told you already and you wouldn't listen. Do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples?" Yes, he ruffled their feathers good and proper. And so they set on him. "You are his disciple. We are Moses' disciples. God spoke to Moses. We don't know anything about this man." And then comes to me what is the most marvelous answer that you could get in the scriptures of this man. And it was the end of the trial, because they couldn't say anything against it. He argued with the conviction of a Queen's Council in his day. In John chapter 9, verse 30. "The man answered and said unto them, Why herein is a marvelous thing. Ye know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if a man be a worshipper of God and doeth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing." They answered and said unto him, "Thou wast altogether born in sins, and they cast, and dost thou teach us? And they cast him out. They were livid. You were born in sins. Do you teach us? Teach us. They threw him out. And yet he'd won the case. He confessed Jesus as the Christ. But that confession would have cost him his new place in society. Not that he ever held any whilst he was blind. Thrown out of the synagogue. Disfellowshipped from society. But the record doesn't end there, because we find that Jesus found that man again. Having represented Jesus in that court case, as it were, Jesus made it his job to find that man again. And the end of the chapter completes our look at this man this morning. Verse 35 of John 9, Jesus heard that they cast him out, and when he had found him, he said unto him, Dost thou believe on the Son of God? He answered and said, Who is it, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said unto him, Thou hast both seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee. The same thing that he actually said to the Samaritan woman in today's readings. And he said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. And Jesus said, For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and that they which see might be made blind. And some of the Pharisees which were there with him heard these words, and said unto him, Are we blind also? Jesus said unto them, If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now ye say, We see. Therefore your sin remaineth. And that was the point of this episode, that teaching, wasn't it? Yet we think of the blind man now with his sight, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. That was the end product of the turning of blindness into sight. I believe. A greater miracle, really, and to us too, than giving the physical sight to this man. Now, like us, he had the spiritual sight as well, and his life was changed dramatically. And so, dear brother and sisters, we come to these emblems this morning with the same conviction. I believe. I was blind, but now I see. He hath opened mine eyes. Yes, our eyes have been opened in the mercy of God. And such is our witness today to the world, though they are spiritually blind, although many of them perceive that they think that they can see, yet they're spiritually blind and they have no hope. But our witness to the world is the same as the witness of this blind man, and we witness it as we remember Jesus today and what he's done for us in the bread and the wine. Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. And we hope and pray, dear brethren and sisters, that that might be a picture of you and of me.